evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real pleasure to be here. Several of you are friends of mine because we were lawyers together once when we were young. And it's my honor to be your speaker tonight. The title of the talk is That Damned Presbyterian War. That is a quote, by the way, from King George III. I didn't make it up. How the Irish and the Scots-Irish won the American Revolution. I'm going to do three things. Number one, why were the Irish and Scots-Irish exceptional fighters? Number two, what is the identity of these people as Irish, Scots-Irish, and Presbyterian? And third, what 18th century contemporary observers thought about the ethnic composition of the American fighting forces.
Up to lunch.
Here we go. Just turn it on. It works every time. Early historians following the American Revolution incorrectly described our fighting forces as Anglo-Saxon. And these included noteworthy men like Henry Cabot Lodge and Alex de Tocqueville. More recent scholarship, however, has identified the Irish and Scots-Irish as at least 40 to 50% of our fighting troops in the Revolutionary War. I first became interested in this topic by reading a book entitled How the Irish Won the American Revolution by Philip Tucker, as well as reading James Webb's book, Born Fighting, How the Scots-Irish Shaped America. In Tucker's book, I noticed that many of the men he described as Irish were born or were from Ulster, the nine counties in northern Ireland, which meant that they had been transplanted over from Scotland. One of these Celtic Gaelic people, and by the way, I think it's appropriate for us to say the Boston Celtics, but the academics all want to use the pronunciation Celtic. Why were these Celtic Gaelic people such great fighters, particularly against the British? I suggest that it was in large measure based on resentment caused by mistreatment. Pope Adrian IV in the mid-12th century, the only English pope, made Henry II Lord of Ireland with right to conquer and right to retain. In 1172, the first English troops took Dublin and Wexford. They never left. In 1534, Henry VIII divorced England and all the land she dominated from the Pope and the Catholic Church. He took all the Irish lands for the crown and granted them to loyalists. He undermined the cultures of Scotland, Wales, and Ireland by outlawing their native Celtic languages. All of the outward signs of traditional Irish Catholicism were forbidden. Abbeys were wrecked, holy relics were burned, and priests were allowed to preach only in English. People were treated like property, and their culture was degraded. That's a picture of the northern counties. Elizabeth I was worse. In her 44 years as queen, there were six Irish rebellions, all bloodily suppressed. As early as 1566 to 1560, during Elizabeth's reign, Sir Henry Gilbert was the, quote, scourge of Ireland. While subduing an uprising in Munster, he required that the path to his tent be lined with the heads of Irish men, women, and children. And as you can see from this ancient language, it brought great terror to the people when they saw the heads of their dead father's brother's children, kinfolk. Not a very nice man. In 1603, James the Sixth of Scotland became James the First of England, and therefore was the first king of what today we call Great Britain. Until his death, he is the James, by the way, of the King James Bible. In James' administration, the British began to replace the Gaelic nobility of the northern counties of Ireland, mostly Catholic, with people from Scotland and northern British counties, mostly Presbyterian. This Irish area was called the Ulster Plantation. It continued filling up during the first half of the 17th century with Scottish Presbyterian people, the closest blood cousins of the Irish. Both groups, by the way, were forced to pay tithes to the Anglican Church. Rents were raised on the Catholics, forcing them off the land. The Protestants were then used as cheap labor, so that both groups, both Catholic and Protestant, were exploited. Between 1641 and 1650, the Catholic ownership decreased from 70% to 10%. In 1641, the Irish Catholic, who had been squeezed out of their land, struck back. On 23rd October 1641, they attacked Dublin Castle. While that attack failed, Northern Ireland later exploded in the warfare, Catholics against Protestants. The defenders who were being run out of their homes primarily were Presbyterian dissenters who had moved from Scotland to escape persecution. There were refugee stories of corpses dug up from Protestant graveyards and flesh sliced from the bodies of living animals. Conversions were forced at the point of a weapon. Atrocities, massacres, and local vendettas were the order of the day. 4,000 settlers were killed, and 8,000 died of exposure and starvation. In Portadown in County Armagh in November of 1641, a group of 100 expelled Protestant settlers were stripped and forced into the frigid waters of the River Bend. All were shot or beaten with oars from rowboats or died of drowning and exposure. But the butcher's bill was yet to be paid. The Protestants' payback began at Island McGee in County Antrim when dozens of Catholics, including women and children, were killed. Many of these were hacked to death. The violent events of 1641 paved the way for a distrust between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, which has persisted for centuries. Meanwhile, in England, King Charles I, married to a Catholic, was beheaded in London on 30 January 1649. His reign was followed by Oliver Cromwell, a Puritan, English general, and statesman who had led roundhead armies of the English Parliament against Charles I. Cromwell assumed the title of Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England. The Protestant Puritans had taken charge. The Irish suppression by Cromwell in Ireland resulted in mass evictions, killings, and the deportation of 50,000 women and children as prisoners of war and indentured servants to Barbados and Bermuda. Some historians have opined that the Commonwealth, through Cromwell, carried out a deliberate program of ethnic cleansing in Ireland. During his ruthless invasion, Cromwell murdered Catholic priests systematically and massacred thousands of Irish Catholics, including civilians and women. In his view, this was a righteous judgment of God. In Cromwell's own words, his holy mission was to extirpate the idolatrous Irish Catholics. He used a deliberate policy of crop burning and starvation with no mercy. In Drogheda, for example, the 2,500-man garrison was put to the sword. 1,000 or so townspeople had taken shelter in St. Peter's Church. Cromwell ordered it burned. All died. In Wexford, 2,000 soldiers and civilians were slaughtered. Following Cromwell was King Charles II, soon followed by his brother, James II. By the way, James in Latin is Jacob. And if you hear the term Jacobite, this is the fellow all that fight occurred because of. James was so unpopular and so ineffective that he soon was forced into exile from Britain. Prominent Britons then asked William of Orange of the Netherlands to be the British king. He agreed, but then James returned. In 1690, William conquered James at the Battle of the Boyne River in Ireland, so James left this time for good. This was not just a battle. Why is Presbyterian so significant here? The answer to this question is complicated. The story begins with Martin Luther and the Reformation. This began with his 95 Theses in Wittenberg, Germany on 31 October 1517. The story continues with John Calvin, a French theologian in Geneva, Switzerland, and John Knox, a Scottish minister, theologian, and writer. Knox was the leader of the Reformation in Scotland and founder of the Presbyterian Church there. The broader story here is that by the mid-1500s, one half of Europe had left the Catholic Church. The English test sacks of the late 1600s were anti-Catholic. Communion must be received only in the Church of England. An oath was required against the Catholic belief in transubstantiation. No office could be held without taking the oath. Catholics were excluded from both houses of Parliament. Close on the heels of the test acts, the Jacobites from April to August 1689 besieged Derry, the second largest Protestant city in Ulster. It is estimated that 4,000 of the 8,000 inhabitants died of injury or starvation before the siege was lifted. In 1697, the penal laws were enacted in Ireland. Priests were outlawed. Irish Catholics could not sit in Parliament or vote in parliamentary elections. They were excluded from the bench, the bar, the university, and all public bodies. They were forbidden to possess arms or a house worth more than £5. They could not buy land. They could not teach school or send a child abroad to be educated. All Catholic land was given to Protestants. If any member of the family did not renounce Catholicism publicly, the father of that family would not be allowed to manage or dispose of property. On a secular note, the 1699 Woolen Act prohibited export of Irish woolen materials just in order to relieve the British wool industry from competition. While the Test Acts went on for decades, the 1703 Queen Anne version harshly and retroactively removed the legality of Presbyterian ministers so that those in Ulster previously married found themselves to be fornicators with children who suddenly and retroactively became bastards. All officeholders were required to take the English sacrament. An Episcopal minister was required for a burial service. Dissenting Presbyterians could not teach school, hold even minor positions in government, or serve in officers in the military. Presbyterian worship was not legal in Ireland until 1713. The Episcopal bishops bitterly opposed it. Presbyterians were excluded from Trinity College Dublin, founded in 1592, until the latter part of the 18th century. Historian Roy Foster described the English actions as tearing Gallicism out by the roots. The Irish people hated their English oppressors. Now, what is the evidence that so many American patriot fighters were Irish and Scots-Irish? The first great Celtic migration to America began in the early 1700s, shortly after the Battle of the Boyne, and did not cease until the beginning of the American Revolution. This began around 1715. These Scots-Irish became America's first radicals. To them, the English Episcopal aristocracy could never be trusted. To them, to London, a Presbyterian ascendancy posed an unacceptable threat. The height of this Celtic Gaelic migration to America occurred between 1700 and 1776. Presbyterian pastor William Martin, for example, led 467 families from Ulster to Charleston. I was just talking to Thomas about South Carolina. Both of us have roots in South Carolina. In this time frame, there were 42 Presbyterian churches in the back country of South Carolina. The mostly Ulster Irish, as well as many Irish Catholics, served as the most radical and revolutionary segments of American society. These people mostly lived in obscurity on the remote western frontier. Many were illiterate. The Irish were considered to be second-class human beings. Those damn Irish and damn the Scots and Irish were common English sentiments. One smug member of the Quaker-dominated Pennsylvania Assembly, when told that Indians had raided and killed many on the western frontier, commented that only some Scots-Irish were killed who could well enough be spared. The Irish had never viewed the mother country as anything but the most dangerous political threat, a symbol of oppression, and the longtime persecutor of free people. This firmly seated revolutionary disposition and inclination, born of a Celtic Gaelic cultural legacy and tragic inheritance, played a large part in setting the stage for the staunch Irish resistance effort throughout the course of the American Revolution. This is a letter I thought would interest you from a Bishop of Londonderry to the Earl of Dartmouth. The most important and central rebellious source across the Middle Colonies stemmed primarily from nearly 300,000 fanatical and hungry Republicans from Northern Ireland who had migrated to Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia only in the course of a few years. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, even in the 18th century, they were already blaming the Republicans. By the 1770s, about two-thirds of those who migrated to America were indentured servants from the absolute lowest rungs of society. The proportion of indentured servants was even higher among the Catholics from the lower portions of Ireland. These two groups were exactly the class of people who had the most to gain from revolution. Some have compared indentured servanthood to slavery because they had to be released after 7 years. Some landowners would work them harder than their fully enslaved people. Their treatment by Britain had highly motivated them to fight hard and to win some personal as well as economic freedom. It was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. In Pennsylvania, the Scots-Irish faction was known as the, quote, Presbyterian Party. It was their first true voice in representative government. In Pennsylvania, the Revolution rode piggyback on Presbyterianism. One observer there doubted that any Presbyterian was loyal to Crown authority because, quote, ancient or present, Presbyterianism and rebellion were twin sisters, sprung from faction and their affection from each other has been ever so strong. In this vein, Thomas Jefferson estimated that 2/3 of all white Virginians were dissenters from the Anglican Church. Here in America, they were all forced to pay tithes to that hated church. Both the Irish, Presbyterians, and Catholics saw nationhood as a path to religious freedom. Their motivation also was economic, as they sought to avoid the excessive rents and sometimes starvation prevailing in Ireland. Author and Senator James Webb said, "Estimates vary, but it is undeniable that the Scots-Irish comprised at least 1/3 and as many as 1/2 of the rebel soldiers during the Revolutionary War." Another historian pegged the Irish presence at 45% of Washington's entire strength. For example, on 31 December 1775, Major General Richard Montgomery died in a driving snowstorm while leading Patriot forces in the attack on Quebec, Canada. Montgomery, a member of the Irish Protestant gentry near Swords, County Dublin, who had attended Trinity College in Dublin, became America's first war hero and martyr to the Patriot cause. When a monument to his memory was enacted in New York City in 1787, nothing on it mentioned his Irish roots. Ironically, the leader of the victorious defending English forces, Governor Sir Guy Carleton, was born in Strabane, County Tyrone in Ulster. General John Sullivan was General Washington's right-hand man in the successful attack on Trenton, New Jersey. He was born in New Hampshire to a father who was an exiled Irish Jacobite rebel. Five Sullivan brothers fought for America's liberty. More than 20 Irishmen or sons of Irish immigrants became generals in the Continental Army or in state militias during the conflict. A total of 22 generals, their fathers or grandfathers, were born in Ireland. Ironically, British Army demographics found 31% of its officers as Irish and 27% Scottish. Just as a parenthetical here, in 1746, there was a battle of Culloden in Scotland, which ended the Highland system. The British thereafter forbade the wearing of plaids, forbade the clans. So, the Scots were Some of them are looking for a job. The Ultra Revolution was properly renamed the American Revolution. Elijah McFarland Sr., Scott Cyrus, was killed in combat on 29 November 1777. His son, David, died of disease in 77. His son, Elijah Jr., died in battle in 78. There are hundreds of examples of similar families. So many Irishmen were enrolled in Washington's large Pennsylvania Continental Line that it was known as the Line of Ireland. Other Celtic Gaelic regiments, quote, provided the backbone of the American Army. Mostly Scots, Irish, and Irish, there were two Continental Pennsylvania infantry brigades, Scots, Irish, Pennsylvanians who spoke with the brogue and burr of Northern Ireland. They were led by the hard-hitting general Mad Anthony Wayne, born to an Irish immigrant. Also prominent in Washington's officer ranks were General Henry Knox of the artillery and Colonel, later General Daniel Morgan, who led the sharpshooters who decimated General Johnny Burgoyne's army at Saratoga and later led victorious American forces at Cowpens in January 1781. Both Knox and Morgan were Irish. Isaac Shelby of Kings Mountain fame was Welsh on his father's side and Scots Irish on his mother's. Scots Irish who fought at the Battle of Kings Mountain included John Brown, brothers David Witherspoon, and Private John Witherspoon, as well as brothers Captain Isaac White and Lieutenant Thomas White. A dozen members of the Campbell clan of Virginia were there, led by Colonel William Campbell, together with 60 men whose names began with Matt. Irishman Captain Thomas Kennedy led a company and a unit commanded by Scots Irish Colonel Joseph MacDowell. Scots Irishman John McCullough lost his father, Lieutenant Thomas McCullough, killed on the way up the mountain. Scots Irish Colonel Thomas Brandon was there, as were Scots Irishman Patrick Carr and Irishman John Weir. When Lord Cornwallis at the Yorktown British surrendered, yes, he called in sick. He wasn't going to surrender his sword. He sent his assistant, his deputy general Charles O'Hara, born of an Irish military family. Now this is, to me, one of the most interesting parts about this. You know, nobody was sitting around with a clicker counting Scots, Irish, and Irish. But the British Parliament established a committee and took sworn testimony about who were the American forces. And these are some of the things. I'm approaching the end here. Washington himself seemed amazed that the colonies had prevailed. Quote, it will not be believed that such a force as Great Britain has employed for 8 years in country could be baffled by numbers infinitely less, composed of men sometimes half-starved, always in rags, without pay, and experiencing at times every species of distress which human nature is capable of undergoing, close quote. He then shows his appreciation of the Irish and Scots-Irish contributions to Ireland winning independence when he said, Ireland was thou friend of my country in my country's most friendless day. British Army Lieutenant William Fielding said in an 18 July 75 letter that the rebel army, quote, is said to be above half Irish and Scotch, but far more of the former than the latter. Captain Frederick Mackenzie of Dublin and the Royal Welsh Fusiliers said in his diary in October 1776, quote, The chief strength of the rebel army at present consists of natives of Europe, particularly Irish. Many of their regiments are composed principally of these men. Close quote. On 27 August 76, Ambrose Searle, Admiral Richard Howe's personal secretary, when thousands of American fighting men were captured, was shot by the sight of the vast numbers of Irish in Washington's ranks. 4 years later, when Charleston finally fell in the spring of 1780, a British officer was astounded by the large number of Irish in the 5,000-man army surrendered by American General Lincoln. Moreover, Captain Johann Heinrichs, an experienced Hessian officer, wrote to a friend in a letter, "Call it not an American rebellion because it is nothing more or less than an Irish Scots Presbyterian rebellion." General Henry Clinton, commanding British troops in America longer than anyone, assessed his opposition thusly. The rebels themselves drew most of their best soldiers from the Irish and other Europeans, especially fighting men from Scotland and Wales, who had recently settled in America. Close quote. King George III, this is his coronation picture, called it that damn Presbyterian War. He elaborated, "Those pestiferous Presbyterians." Have we got any pestiferous Presbyterians? I see a few hands raised. "Those pestiferous Presbyterians are always in unrest and will be until they are wiped out." Sorry. Should have kept your hand down. General Charles Lee was Washington's top lieutenant after the Battle of Bunker Hill. He held the Irish in contempt because there were very few of them that appear gentlemen who consequently cannot have a proper sense of honor. An investigative committee in the House of Commons, here you go, in London in 1779, heard this under oath from Major James Robertson. Quote, "I remember General Lee telling me that he believed half the rebel army were from Ireland." Another parliamentary committee member was Joseph Galloway, a Maryland-born loyalist, former Speaker of Pennsylvania's House of Assembly, and Benjamin Franklin's friend, who was asked to give sworn testimony on the composition of Washington's army. He described it as, quote, "scarcely one-fourth natives of America, about one-half Irish. The other fourth were English and Scottish." So the reason I became a lawyer was so I wouldn't have to do arithmetic. But if you notice here, he considered the fighting forces to be 75% either Irish or Scots. According to Galloway, the majority of the men who fought against England and America were of Irish extraction. At the end of the parliamentary investigation, Luke Gardner, the future Lord Mountjoy, hit the nail on the head when he told the House of Commons in Parliament that they had lost control of the colonies in a manner that today has been largely forgotten. He declared, "You have lost America by the Irish." Mr. Chairman, that concludes my talk.
Yay for the Irish.
Yay.